From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
At a recent plant sale at Hollister House Gardens in Connecticut, I stopped by the booth of Cricket Hill Garden. Known for 30 years as producers of exceptional tree peonies and herbaceous peonies too. But one row in their display didn't look like peonies at all. I didn't know what the plants were till I looked at the tags, which turned out to be unusual fruits like medlar and melonberry and pawpaw for edible landscaping. Cricket Hill's Daniel Furman is here to talk about those and some peonies too, but first this message.
Underwriting support from Timber Press, your go-to resource for books in gardening and nature. Whether you're a new gardener, a professional at the top of your field, or a reader interested in the wonders of the natural world, their books are there to help you grow. TimberPress.com.
About 10 years ago, Dan Furman joined the nursery and mail order operation his parents, Kasia and David, started in 1989 in Connecticut to specialize in Chinese tree peonies, still a mainstay of the family business. Well, Dan brought with him a growing interest in edible ornamentals, and he says, to make landscapes more bountiful, not just beautiful. And with lots of personal research and experimentation, he has added a great assortment of them to the Cricket Hill lineup. Welcome, Dan. I'm so excited that I saw you at the booth the other day.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me, Margaret. I really appreciate it.
Oh, it's so fun because I had no idea, and I feel so ignorant because I think of Cricket Hill as peonies. You know, I admitted that just again now and in the introduction that I think of you as synonymous with fabulous peonies. And this is, the fall is sort of peak peony ordering and planting time. I was thinking maybe, you know, you have not only, I think your parents began with tree types and then evolved to the herbaceous, but there's that in-between kind, too, that I'm kind of interested in. Can you tell us a little bit about those?
Yeah, so known as the intersectional, or pretty commonly in the trade, is Ito peonies.
Ito, I-T-O-H.
Yeah, and that is to commemorate Toshi Ito, who is a Japanese nurseryman who was the first person to do the successful cross between the tree and herbaceous peony in the late 40s. And so, kind of tragically, he actually died before he saw his first seedlings bloom.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, so he had no idea. He passed away in the early 50s, and they didn't bloom, I think, until the mid-50s. And so it was actually, I think, his son-in-law or someone who was related to the nursery who introduced them first in Japan and then in the U.S. They were kind of a sensation, first of all, because they were yellow, and second of all, because they are these interesting crosses that have the flowers and leaf like a tree peony, but that green herbaceous stem that dies back in the fall.
So you say they're yellow, but when
that was the original,
right?
Yeah.
I have one called, I think, Bartzella.
Yes. That? Yeah.
And then another one that's a golden something. What? What's some of the other gold ones? I can't remember.
There's Golden Crown. There's Oriental Gold.
But when I look in your catalog, and you know, which is you have mail order operation as well as do you have some open days there where people come?
Yeah, definitely. In the spring, we're open. You know, basically like a regular garden center during peony bloom, and then throughout the summer and fall, more limited hours.
And so people come and chop. But when they look at the assortment, it's not just yellow ones in these intersectionals, right?
Yeah. So there have been a couple American breeders, and now a few in France and Belgium and Western Europe. But it's really some of the American breeders who have done the most to sort of advance these new intersectional hybrids, particularly gentleman Roger Anderson from Wisconsin. And so there's some beautiful kind of peaches and rose and apricot, more kind of subtle tones, not just that really vibrant yellow. Some dark reds, and even a white, which is not very commonly available still. What's interesting with these intersectionals is they've been picked up by some of the really big nurseries like Monrovia, you know, and it's kind of it's becoming the most commonly available peony at this point. I was just talking to a Dutch importer who sells them to Costco, And so, you know,
oh my
they're
goodness.
Going to Costco, you know, it's kind of the mass market peony.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Because not very many, I mean, I'm not 200 years old yet, but not so many years ago, these were quite a rare thing.
Roger Anderson, who is the breeder, mm-hmm. he opted not to patent them, but rather sell the divisions for, you know, pretty exorbitant prices. So I know the Bartzella, when it was first introduced in the early 90s, it was like $850, you know, for a little tiny division.
Yes.
And so they're tissue cultured now, and so that's why the volume is,
yes.
you know, the nurseries are able to produce.
So reproduced in the laboratory, so to speak, on the scale,
tens of thousands.
Yes. Oh, my goodness. But you have some very unusual ones.
Yeah, that's, you know, our nursery is kind of more set up to do the niche things, you know, things you can't get at Home Depot or
yes.
Costco. So,
yes. Yeah. So peonies and you know, I'll give people with the transcript of this show, I'll give them the links and they can drool
yeah.
over both your tree peony assortment, which is quite amazing,
yeah.
and the herbaceous ones, and then these intersectionals in between. But what I was so surprised, as I said in the introduction, was that
yeah.
you had all these plants at your booth, and I was like, what's a melon berry?
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's the nice thing about having a small nursery is you can let it reflect your own idiosyncratic interests.
Uh-oh. Are you a little idiosyncratic over there, Dan?
That's really been my interest is expanding our offerings, because really peonies I think of as, you know, it's the opposite from a it's like as far away as you could get from a practical utilitarian plant.
Right.
Even though its roots in China originally was as a medicinal plant, as with many things, you know,
yes.
in our gardens. But at this point, you know, it's all about the show, and it really is spectacular, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing that compares to a peony blossom. But you know, my interest is to make, yeah, like you said in the intro, you know, these landscapes that are productive and fruitful as well as beautiful. And
yeah.
so some of these unusual fruit trees really fit well into that scheme.
So I bet that you and I have a friend in common in Lee Reich, because Lee a million years ago wrote Uncommon Fruits Worthy of Attention, and then in more recent years has written another fruit book. And so I mean, he's been growing in upstate New York oddball fruits, but so I assume like you, like
yeah,
I have
he's been a very a bit of a mentor towards me, and I'm really grateful to you know, have had been able to speak with him, and he has a great collection of stuff, and so he's shared some of his usual varieties that I've been able to propagate.
What could be them? I saw that you, for instance, offer the Nanking cherry.
Yes.
And that's something he extols the virtues of.
Tell
us a little bit about that plant,
The Prunus tomentosa. Mm-hmm. It's got this sort of hairy leaves, hence the name. Blooms very early. I guess forsythia and the cornus moss, the cornelian cherry, are some of the first things to bloom here, but then quickly followed by the Nanking cherry, usually in anywhere from late March to early April. Really nice, showy kind of prunus bloom, followed by really delicious tart cherries that ripen right around the 4th of July.
Huh.
The birds love them, so you do have to be prepared to have some sort of bird and chipmunk.
Or share.
strategy, or just share.
Yes.
But the nice thing is they really are bushes. They only get about 6.5 or 7 feet tall, so
yes.
a lot easier to net than a full-size cherry tree.
Yeah. Well, I mentioned one of the funniest tags that I turned over, I think, when I was there was at the plant sale the other day, was melonberry.
Yes.
And I was like, what in the world?
Yeah, so that is a plant that I definitely learned of from Lee Reich's book.
Oh.
In English, it's called Che.
Like
which
Che
is
Guevara?
A,
like the...
Yeah, like the
Che Guevara.
Cuban revolutionary. But that is actually just a mispronunciation of the Chinese name for it, which is
Zhe
in Mandarin.
I see.
Yeah. And in China, it's been cultivated for several hundred years, sort of for the fruit, though I haven't been able to find a ton of Chinese sources about use for the fruit, but mainly because it's a mulberry relative, used as a feedstock for the silkworms. And so I have a couple varieties of this. The Latin for it is Cadrina, I believe is the genus. Mm-hmm. It may have just been changed recently.
Don't worry about that.
The species is really unpronounceable, but people can look at it online.
Yes, exactly.
I have a couple varieties of that that I actually graft onto Osage Orange, mulberry relative.
That surprised me. I didn't know that Osage Orange, you know, is that Maclura? Is that what you call it? Yeah. And so that was like, what? This is a cousin of that? That's so funny. And so now you graft it onto that. So you use the rootstock of the Osage Orange. And is this to make it more durable or to keep it a certain size or what's the point of that?
Well, yeah, it's, I mean, I have grown them for the Che from cuttings also, but with less success. The grafting I've gotten down where it's very successful. And it does seem to make a more tree-like form, where if it's on its own roots, it's a little bit shrubbier.
Okay.
So some people might think of that as an advantage. Obviously, you can always bury the graft union if you wanted the tree to root on its own and get it on its own roots.
Yeah, and there are these crazy-looking, I mean, from the pictures, I didn't see them in fruit.
You know,
yeah, there are these crazy kind of fruits.
They look like little brains, sort of.
They do. I was going to say, it's. I don't know how to describe it, but that's a good one.
Yeah. They have these funny little lobes to them.
Yeah.
And the one thing I will caution people is they really like a long, hot summer to ripen well. And so I have not actually successfully ripened them here in northwestern Connecticut.
So your customers who are succeeding with them are probably in a slightly
farther south,
right,
growing them in hoop houses.
Excellent.
So that's something I'm going to try is doing them in hoop houses. Also, many people, like mulberries, the female trees will produce seedless fruit without pollination. The issue with that is that that fruit takes a longer season to ripen. So if you have pollinated fruit, it will ripen faster. So I've recently gotten some males to pollinate my female trees and see if that will shorten up the season.
Okay. I saw that you have a number of kinds of pears, and one is called a perry, P-E-R-R-Y pear, and I thought, what? Again, I was like, what is a perry pear? What does that mean?
So perry is the, I guess, the old English word for just cider made of pear juice, fermented
pear
juice.
I'm just not up with the drinking culture, I guess, enough.
Well,
I've got to get with it.
Hudson Valley, it's really,
I know, I've got to get.
All these cider places. I think the perry is only going to follow the cider.
Okay, all right. So these are pears not for eating out of hand, but for making cider. Okay.
Yeah, they're small and they're very astringent, very tannic.
Okay.
Not a ton of sugars.
Uh-huh.
But a lot of them have really cool history, and you know, they go back several hundred years from England and Germany and France. So
I take it that you enjoy the research part of getting to know these fruits.
Yes, very much. That's a big part of it for me, is understanding the history behind them and the just the stories. So, because, it, you know, it's their food, and there are always just wonderful stories associated with that and the culture, and then the connections that I can make with customers. That's always really fun. One of the things I love growing are the cornelian cherry, cornice moss.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Yeah, you know, planted as an ornamental here, I think, for quite a while, but also produces edible fruit, which is ripe right around now or a little bit earlier. And, you know, the fruit here is just kind of an afterthought, kind of like on the Coosa dogwood, where it's like, oh, it's a nice show of fruit in the fall.
Right.
But you know, I have a friend who's from Moldova, and her absolute favorite fruit are cornelian cherries.
Isn't that funny?
So it's
Moldova.
Really just, you know, it's totally cultural, whatever, you know, it is that we, you know, that our tastes are sort of attuned to. And it's expanding that palate, I think, is something that's really fun. You know, it's both the palate of plants that we use and also the, you know, what we eat. So,
well, I think I only have one or two cornice moss in my garden, and they're very, very early, beautiful, puffy, yellow blossoms. And I love gold, the color gold, notches of blossom. So I have a gold leaf one. In the plant. And when I saw, so I'm always buying gold leaf plants. I'm not supposed to buy any more plants ever again. But when I saw in your listing that you have another favorite plant, elderberries, but you have a gold leaf elderberry, I was like, oh no.
Deadly.
Yeah. So elderberries are another thing.
That is, I think of them as wonderful plants because, you know, you can fit them into the landscape where a lot of other fruiting plants won't necessarily do very well, sort of on the margins of a stream or a pond. They like that kind of very rich, moist, organic soil. You know, if you don't get to harvesting the fruit, the birds just love it. Great nectar source for pollinators in June. And they just have this great habit about them. You know, if you don't prune them, they get up to over 10 feet tall. And
as they are at Margaret's. Oops. I know. And you can really cut them back hard, and they still do their thing. But it's kind of fabulous when they tower. I have them in an out-of-the-way spot. And so, you know, they're in the background, and they're fine. And the birds just love them.
One thing I found are the, you know, I've... customers, some European customers, they're very insistent that they want the European species, the Fungus nigra. And there are some nice varieties of those. You know, there's a variegated leaf one, you know, ornamental, and then there are those lace leaf, the dark foliage. But I don't know what your experience is. Mine are, you know, I can grow them for 4 or 5 years, and they get pretty big, and then they just kick the bucket.
Yeah, I have the American.
Yeah. I would suggest that people stick with the American.
Which is nice because, again, it's a native plant, and it's great for pollinators, and it's great for birds and small mammals later. So even if you don't harvest it yourself and make, you know, whatever you want to make, syrup or something like that. Yeah. You have a number of things also that are tree-like. Some, again, speaking of Native American, like a persimmon and a pawpaw. So tell us a little bit about those. These are more trees.
So both, you know, pawpaws, they're small trees. They can get up to, well, if you don't prune them, probably 30 feet. And the persimmons also, you know, over time, will get to a pretty significant size. Yeah, I mean, both were, I think, in their season, you know, eaten extensively by Native Americans. And the first European explorers... certainly with the pawpaw and also persimmon, were noted and enjoyed. And it's just two of these native fruits that kind of fell off the radar for a couple hundred years, seemingly. But are both kind of having their moment or a renaissance or something right now.
Yes, they're things.
And I think long overdue. Certainly in the case of the pawpaw, there is, before we all, you know, stop eating peaches and just plant pawpaws everywhere, there is perhaps a link between a lot of consumption of pawpaw fruit, and it's in the Ananaceae family, and a certain strain of Parkinson's disease. So there's, this is some new research, I think, from the University of Ohio, where pawpaw, pawpaws are endemic there, and so they're doing some research. So a little bit of a cautionary note, you know, but it would seem that it's need to eat a lot of the fruit for there to be any negative.
Right, and as a curiosity, as a sort of onesie or twosie in a garden, and it's the largest fruit native to North America. Which is kind of fun in itself.
Yeah,
and then the persimmons, you have the there's the Asian persimmon, but there's the American persimmon.
So I, you know, I kind of first fell in love with the Asian persimmons during some traveling I did abroad, and then wanted to try growing those here. And unfortunately, in Zone 6, they really don't do very well. Die back to the ground. But the American persimmons are totally hardy here, and if anything, I think more flavorful than the Asian persimmons. The issue is the fruit is just, it's a little smaller. But really a beautiful tree, really nice glossy foliage. It kind of has a dominant central leader if you don't prune it, but you can get it to, like, cutting out the leader to get it to have a nice fuller form. And you can, if you want to play a really cruel prank on someone, you can give them a persimmon when it's just starting to turn orange, but before the astringency has left it, and they will never forget that.
Oh, I'm getting goosebumps.
Yeah, no, I at the plant sale this past weekend, someone had, like, you know, like, had PTSD from when they had an unripe persimmon like 10 years ago, and they were recounting how terrible it was.
Oh my goodness! Oh, and then you have medlars as well, yeah?
Yeah, yeah.
Related to hawthorns, I think.
Hawthorn, yeah. Quince,
yeah.
Pear, yeah.
Right, right, right.
Yeah, it's in the rose family.
Yeah,
yeah. They were, you know, all the rage in Elizabethan England, and just didn't quite make the leap into modernity, but. Nice tree, doesn't get any of the kind of foliar issues that, you know, a lot of the your apples and pears will. Because the fruit stays so hard so long into the season, really doesn't have any pest issues. So you don't have the curculio and whatnot making holes in your fruit.
And I think
just a nice small tree. And, you know, you look at any of those like still lifes from, I guess, the 16th century, you know, the Dutch masters or whatever, where they would paint the basket of fruit. There's always a medlar in there.
It's funny. I think there's a word for, you said that this fruit stays hard for a long time, and I think people who have them ripen them indoors, maybe.
Yeah.
And I think there's a word for that.
I believe it's blet.
Bletted.
You bled the fruit.
I bletted the fruit.
you let it rot. And then it's edible.
Indoors until it's edible,
Yeah, they're very good, though. They're very sweet. And it's. I would liken them just to sort of like applesauce, you know.
Inside, once they're ripe,
Once they're soft, yeah.
Huh. So lots more things in the assortment and at Cricket Hill, and we have a few minutes left, and I wanted just to sort of backtrack to, how big a place is it, the nursery?
The nursery? The total property, we're on 40 acres, and it's mostly sloped, swampy, rocky woodland. We're kind of in my parents' era, they cleared about 2 acres, left a lot of the big oaks and maples, so there's a lot of high shade, and that's sort of our display garden with the peonies. And I've squeezed fruit trees here, there, where I can over the last 10 years or so. And then about 8 years ago, I cleared a quarter acre and planted that with kind of my specimen planting of a lot of these fruit trees. And
right.
So those are now my propagation source for them, for the cyanwood. And then we grow plants in containers as well as in the ground.
Right.
Yeah, so there's a lot going on.
And just in the last minute or two, you research and you ferret out these things, and if you come upon a variety of something, where do you go to find it? Do you get it from like that, one of those germplasm repositories that I've read about?
That has been a very good source. So incredibly, the USDA still maintains these like living, germplasm repository. So they have varieties of all these different fruit trees that they maintain living specimens of. And anyone in the U.S. can request propagation material during the winter, and you will be sent, free of charge, by the way, budwood for grafting from the specimen trees. So, you know, it's our government...
Another benefit of paying your taxes.
Yeah, exactly.
Huh?
Exactly. We may, you know, you may wonder where it all goes sometimes, but...
Yeah. Well, I'm just, again, like I said at the beginning, I'm just so glad that we intersected at that pandemonium of that event the other day. and that you were there, and that you had not just the peonies, which were looking gorgeous in their bags all ready to go to their new homes, but also these crazy fruits. So I'll give lots more information. And I think you have some events coming up as well.
Yeah. So this coming weekend, I have a peony propagation workshop where all aspects of making more peonies will be explained and demystified. Mm-hmm. And then on, I think it's October 14th, I have a edible landscaping walk.
Oh, cool.
We're going to go through and taste some late-season Asian pears and some medlars and some pawpaws. So that will be a lot of fun.
So I'll give the links. I'll get those links from you, and I'll give the links with the transcript to that to those as well so people can come visit, hopefully, as well.
Oh, thank you so much, Margaret.
All right.
I really appreciate
it. I'm so glad to talk to you, Dan, and I hope it'll be the first of many conversations.
Excellent.
Okay.
Have a great day.
You too.
Underwriting support from Timber Press, your go-to resource for books in gardening and nature. Whether you're a new gardener, a professional at the top of your field, or a reader interested in the wonders of the natural world, their books are there to help you grow. TimberPress.com.
Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version of the show on Stitcher or iTunes or Spotify. And you can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com or at Facebook or Instagram as @awaytogarden. And happy gardening meantime.
Away to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.